Hello again, everybody. It's so wonderful to be with you on such a beautiful, beautiful morning in Santa Clarita. When I was thinking of being here with you today, I couldn't help but think of John Muir. He had some connection to Pasadena and Eaton Canyon. He had some local haunts here. He hiked the canyon and he wrote about it. And I also got to thinking about his writings. I was recently given a first edition of the Mountains of California by my mother-in-law. A wonderful gift. And when I was reading through his work again, the Mountains of California, My Summer in the Sierras, and so on, I noticed that there was a word that he liked to use a lot, that he had a tendency to use, and that's the word glorious. It's not a word you hear too much anymore, unless you're singing in a choir, maybe. But Muir used it a lot, and he used it often in reference to light, but also other things. He used it to describe the way the sun greets the mountains in the morning, the way the trees toss their branches in glorious enthusiasm during a storm, and the way light filters through a sugar pine forest. He writes, "How glorious the shining after the short summer showers and after frosty nights when the morning sunbeams are pouring through the crystals on the grass and pine needles. And how ineffably spiritually fine is the morning glow on the mountaintops and the aspen glow of evening. Well may the Sierra be named not the snowy range, but the range of light." And I bring this up because John Muir had an almost ecstatic sense of nature. He was North America's homegrown nature mystic. For him, the natural world was often suffused with the divine. And the word glorious has connotations of magnificence, beauty, splendor, delight, but also an older sense of the word bliss, in the sense of heaven, the bliss of heaven. And when I think about this special connection to the earth, I think that maybe we need to rethink Earth Day a little. Can Earth Day be about something greater than the latest green products and sustainable initiatives? As much as many of those initiatives, as wonderful as they are, and for religious communities, can it especially be about reinstilling a sense of awe and wonder in the divine, in nature, and our connection to it? A lot of these songs here this morning are really working to do that, a lot of what we've already done. I'd like to suggest two ways that we might find our way back into a sense of the glorious, the awe and the wonder. One is a sense of place. Where are we? The other is a sense of time. When are we? Today we're suffering from a disease of dislocation. We don't have a sense of where we are a lot. In place, our home bioregions gets lost in the hurry and flurry of everyday life. And we don't have a clear sense of when we are in the unfolding of the evolutionary story. Science is giving us that gift more and more. But who we are has a lot to do with an awareness of where we are and where we've come from. Some years ago, I interviewed Bill McKibben, who some of you may know, environmental activist, nature author, climate change activist. He founded the organization 350.org. There's a big climate change march next weekend. And I interviewed him on the topic of his book, The Age of Missing Information. This is one of his older books. And what he did in this book, he conducted a kind of experiment on himself. And he subjected himself to hours and hours of television programming, over 90 cable television stations for a period of about a week. Then he spent an equivalent amount of time on a mountaintop in the Adirondacks where he grew up. And he compared the two experiences and how it felt, how he felt emotionally, psychologically, how he felt even physically. And very contrasting experiences. And when I asked him what he hoped to find in this experiment, here's what he said in the interview. He said, "I wanted to understand the ideology of the time, which didn't seem to be a political ideology, really, but a consumer one. TV somehow had the key to all that. So I watched all that endless TV, and I spent all that time outdoors. And if you had to boil the whole thing down to one idea, an idea that TV spreads with incredible efficiency, it's that we are the most important things in the world. We're the center. Each one of us as individuals is incredibly important. All of our wants should be gratified. We should be amused at all times. That's what life is about. It's sort of the ideology of the suburb, the ideology of Disneyland. And I came to understand this ideology as being very much against both an ecological worldview and a religious worldview. These are worldviews where we're not the center of everything." But then Bill talked about something he noticed about the children in his area at the same time. Whereas he remembered running around the trails of the Adirondacks as a boy, almost constantly outside with his siblings and friends, he noticed that the kids were inside a lot, in front of their Game Boys, their TVs. And he came to see that, quote, TV was a place where children live. End quote. So not only does TV make us more self-centered, it becomes a kind of habitat in which we live. Now, this was predating the time of smartphones and the prevalence of computers, and so fast forward to today, and we now live in a time when there's a vast proliferation of these devices. We live in an ecosystem of interruption technologies. We become hunter-gatherers in a data collection forest. The internet's has ushered in a kind of placelessness where we think we exist somewhere out there in cyberspace, when in reality we're embodied beings. And we do live in time and space. So do we directly experience the world around us? Or is everything mediated by a smartphone, Facebook, the internet? The Cartesian duality of I think, therefore I am, discounts the interdependence of everything, that we are part and parcel of the earth and of our bodies. When we're distracted by input from all directions, our attention is spread thin. Our ability to be present, to see what is right around us, diminishes. We can feel lost and frustrated. So we need to find ourselves again. The capacity to be still, to find again that part of us that artist Agnes Martin calls the unconditioned self. I came across this idea of hers at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art recently. There's a wonderful exhibit of her paintings there. And if anyone knows Agnes Martin's work, her later work became very, very subtle lines and patches of color on a grid. And when you look at them, there's this profound sense of presence and of peacefulness. And you start to feel that kind of unconditioned self. The unconditioned self is a part of us that is beyond our social conditioning. Beyond thought, beyond ideas, beyond words, it's a pure embodied presence to everything around us. We open ourselves to the love that presses in all around us. We wait in readiness and patience for a deepening state of self-awareness. The more distracted we are, the more we lose our sense of place, the more we are impeded from reaching that unconditioned part of ourselves. the poet Mary Oliver calls us back to that part of ourselves. What can I say that I have not said before? So I'll say it again. The leaf has a song in it. Stone is the face of patience. Inside the river, there is an unfinishable story, and you are somewhere in it. And it will never end until it all ends. Take your busy heart to the art museum and the Chamber of Commerce, but take it also to the forest. The song you heard singing in the leaf when you were a child is singing still. I am of years lived, so far 74, and the leaf is singing still. Age 74, and she's still got that sense of presence, of bliss, of openness, of getting to that unconditioned self. It's available to all ages if we're in the right state of awareness. So awareness of where we are, a fullness of presence to our place, is one part of reinstilling bliss, awe, wonder, glory. But a sense of when we are, at what point in the story around us, is another piece. The emergent process of the universe has resulted in something really quite amazing. The appearance of a being through which the universe reflects on its own magnificence. The human is the way through which the universe feels the glory in a sunrise, a pine forest, or the light in the Sierras. For the first time, we have a story, this gift of science, that can give us a deep sense that we have a role in the universe. Perhaps that role is simply that we're here to celebrate magnificence. We're not just dropped down here, but we've emerged from within the story of the Earth and within the story of the universe. We're children of the planet. We're not here at the behest of a transcendent being, but to personalize and further evolution's thrust in self-awareness and celebration. The more multifaceted that story, the richer the experience, the more vivid our imagination, the deeper the sense of the divine. It's why species diversity and extinction are so important. Why should we care about the African elephant? Why should we care about the polar bear or the Delta smelt, for that matter? Because each being is a manifestation of the divine, and each is a one-time endowment of the evolutionary process. Once gone, they can never come back again. St. Thomas Aquinas said, "Why are there so many things? Because the divine couldn't image itself forth in any one being, it created a diversity of same, so that the perfection lacking to one would be supplied by the others, and the whole universe together would participate in and manifest the divine more than any one being whatsoever. Things cannot be seen simply in their isolated selves. Nothing is itself without everything else." So we can't really truly be our deepest selves without the biodiversity around us, because they're all part of an interwoven tapestry that enriches the story. Pull out one thread, the larger beauty of the rug is compromised. Pull out too many and the rug ceases to function as a rug. It just falls apart. Having a unifying story helps orient us in this time of destabilization and globalization, where old stories are no longer adequate to that task. It becomes essentially a question of identity. Who are we? At any one moment of crisis, the universe has responded with unprecedented creativity. Life has found a way. And this can give us hope, even faith in the human prospect. My mentor and teacher, Thomas Berry, wrote about this faith in the human prospect. He said, the basic mood of the future might well be one of confidence in the continuing revelation that takes place in and through Earth. If the dynamics of the universe from the beginning shaped the course of the heavens, lighted the sun, and formed the earth, if this same dynamism brought forth the continents and the seas and atmosphere, if it awakened life in the primordial cell and then brought into being the unnumbered variety of living beings and finally brought us into being and guided us safely through the turbulent centuries, there is reason to believe that this same guiding process is precisely what has awakened in us our present understanding of ourselves and our relation to this stupendous process. Sensitized to such guidance from the very structure and functioning of the universe, we can have confidence in the future that awaits the human venture. So when our breath is taken away by a 3,000-year-old redwood, a seashore vista, the delicacy of a wildflower petal, the burnt sienna of a salamander's flesh in sunlight, we're remembering that we, too, are part of the magnificence. And we're here to say, glorious, glorious. We're here. We are the universe itself, shimmering in awe. So awareness of place to tell us where we are, awareness of story to tell us when we are, and these lead us ultimately to an awareness of self. Not the small self that Bill McKibben was talking about, but of a self connected to a mind that's part of a larger ecological self. That third awareness is the most basic. And the purpose of life may well even be seen as getting to know the true unconditioned self. That's where we'll find true glory. John Muir had this sense of the glorious, and it powered his conservation efforts that have given us sacred places like Yosemite in which to play and pray, as he put it. These all amount to what I call a practice of spiritual ecology. It's a practice that leads us to a new way of being human beyond the limited identity of consumer. And it places us in an exciting role of the cosmic citizen in an unfolding story. It also provides us the basis for and strengthens us for a fierce activism in defense of life and planet. And boy, do we live in a time when we need fierce activism in defense of life and the planet. Our experiences of these places can be both serene and challenging. The poet William Stafford writes, I like to live in the sound of water, in the feel of mountain air. A sharp reminder hits me, this world is alive. It stretches out there, shivering toward its own creation, and I'm part of it. Even my breathing enters into the elaborate give and take, this bowing to sun and moon, day and night, winter, summer, storm, still, this tranquil chaos that seems to be going somewhere, this wilderness with a great peacefulness in it, this motionless turmoil, this everything dance. So, let's rethink Earth Day. In addition to all the good Earth Day projects and activities, creek cleanup, recycling, tree planting, and so on, let's make it especially a day of remembering the magnificence of which we're a part. Let's take time together with friends and loved ones to stop and feel the presence of the sacred, to get a sense of glory within us and around us. At the very least, take a first step and tell someone to have a glorious day. And a glorious life. Let the glory in, the light in, and spread it around. Let's celebrate Earth Day.